Howdy, y'all, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hell, and of course, joining me, as always, the Zach Morris to my AC Slater, Mr. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Hope everybody's doing really good. I hope everybody's enjoying their February. It's almost over. Spring's going to be here before you know it.
I hope somebody's having some cold weather, because Kyle and I, we're not having it. It's been like close to 80 down here the last few days, and shorts, flip-flops, t-shirt.
Yeah, nice.
Me and some friends, we went to a little brewery over there in Fort Worth, Raw and Sons, and drank some beer this weekend and hung out over there, and it was really, really nice. It was funny. I'm sitting around in February, and I'm hot. I'm like, this is ridiculous, man. Like we were talking about, I almost had to turn the air on just to go to sleep. I'm like, how sad is that? I like it cool, but I'm like, it's February. I got to turn the damn air conditioner. That's ridiculous.
Global warming, my friend. It's reality.
Right?
So right. What's new in your world besides going to the brewery?
Just that's about it. Little fishing, little reading, little beer drinking, and just having a good time and getting prepared for this show. And got some really interesting stuff. Folks, we're going to touch on something that we hadn't really planned on touching on today's show. But due to all y'all inundating us with emails, and I do mean piles of them, we were surprised that everybody wants to hear about Mail's Hole. It's popped up here and there, so we're like, okay, everybody, we'll do it. We'll do some digging around and come up with some stuff. So did some digging around, and me and Kyle are going to have some fun with it. But before we get into Mail's Hole, I got to run something past you that I found, guys, that's pretty interesting. Now, Kyle and I discussed a company a while back, Terrafugia, and it was actually a company that was founded in 06, and it's a bunch of MIT aerospace engineers graduated from there, of course, and what they're doing is they're working to build a flying car. That's actually what their concept is. And looks like they're getting somewhere with this. Released on the 1st of this month, it said that they were pleased to share that they have successfully completed static load testing of a scale prototype of the TFX wing. This test verified that the 1/10 scale carbon fiber wing will be able to safely withstand the necessary loads during wind tunnel testing, and is an essential step along the path towards the development of the TFX for the vision of the future. And basically what the vision of their future is a plug-in hybrid electric flying car with semi-autonomous flight and vertical takeoff and landing capabilities. And they think now, as released of the first, they should enter production in 8 to 12 years, what they're looking to do. So basically, you know, compiling all that, they built this wing out of some good material, did a lot of testing. They say, okay, this is the safe way. This is what we're going to do. Now, Terrafugia actually is a derived from a Latin term, escape the Earth, which is a really awesome thing. I'm going to give you some quick facts about this vehicle. Like
please.
I said, the TFX. Like I told you, it's 8 to 12 years out. They say the pricing will be consistent of a high-end luxury car, but their safety is what I really enjoy. They say that statistically safer than driving a modern automobile. It's also capable of automatically avoiding other air traffic, bad weather, and restricted and tower-controlled airspace. It also says that it'll have full backup parachute system, which can be activated by the operator in an emergency if the operator believes that it is incapable of auto-landing. If the operator declares an emergency, which will automatically notify authorities of the situation, it can be landed in non-approved landing zones. Here's a cool thing, Philly. If the operator becomes unresponsive, it'll automatically implement an emergency auto-land to the nearest airport. So say you had a stroke while you're flying your car, it'll take you to safety. Now, here's cool. It can carry 4 people in the comfort of like a car. It'll have a non-stop flight range of at least 500 miles. It'll fit in a standard construction single car garage, can take off vertically from a level clearing of at least 100 foot in diameter. It will be able to drive on roads and highways. So you can drive it around. You can pop it up and fly. You can do all this with it. The reason I tell you all this is because the New York Post just reported on this, that it says that this comes from Yaron Steinbeck, says that the flying vehicle makes the Jetsons car seem like a jalopy. Terrafugia, like I told you when it was founded, they actually bumped it up, and they expect a full-sized unmanned prototype of the car by 2018. And here's the wild thing. Drivers won't even need a pilot's license because of the car's semi-automated flight technology. Now, the company spokeswoman, Dagny Dukach, said that this will catalyze a revolution in personal mobility. Says with simplified flight controls, a familiar layout, and automated vertical takeoff and landing technology, the TFX will make personal aviation more accessible than ever before. So instead of 8 to 12 years, They are going to come out with one by 2018, unmanned, of course, so they can start running all the tests on it. Now, imagine this. The reason I went into all this is because I'm thinking this. We talked about the Google cars. Imagine you've got something like this, automated Google car system that can drive or fly. So the weather's nice, you take to the air. Weather's bad, you stay on the ground. It drives itself. It dodges other traffic in the air. See, that's what you have to have. I mean, that's the one thing that we always, you know, forget about.
Right.
Or you forget to think when you start thinking about vehicles in the air, is all the other vehicles in the air. We run into each other now, except when you run into each other, you don't fall a few thousand feet to the ground. So you would have to have some sort of guidance system where it would know what was going on. But we're to the point now to where we have that technology. So this is something within the next 20 years, folks, that could definitely be a reality. Imagine this. Imagine some grandparents. Maybe they got bad eyesight, like we always talk about them trying to get back and forth, you know, and maybe not be able to get to the doctor and things. And these Google cars would be helpful, you know, or to take. Now imagine you can fly them. I'm assuming it's going to be, of course, low altitude flight. Of course, it's not a pressurized cabin, I don't imagine. So, and it's at least 500 miles is what they're talking about. So not a long ways. Now, here's what's cool. If you land it, the motor itself will generate the power to recharge it. And also you can plug it in. So you could legitimately set it up. An old folks could leave their house. Not even old folks, anybody could leave their house on a trip. You could fly 500 miles, land it. Then you could plug it in. And if it's going 200 miles an hour, you're talking 2.5 hours. We're rocking, baby.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man.
And boom, you're done. Yeah, you plug it in while you're eating dinner or eating lunch. You unplug it. There's you another 500 miles. Talking about covering 1,000 miles pretty quick. You could, you know, grandparents could make a pretty quick trip to come see some grandkids right there.
Yeah, but is it going to be a problem if the sky's inundated and just filled with all of these things?
I don't think it will, because it's going to be just like it's not a problem with high performance race cars on the highway, because not everybody can afford them.
That's true.
So that's going to be the price line is going to be the breaking point of the whole thing. So with that, it's going to take it down, but it is going to be something. Of course, it's like anything else. How much longer until once this comes out and, you know, like we talked about with the Tesla masses, and all that stuff, till they start, you know, open sourcing it. And the next thing you know, there's more and more of them in the air. So I think it's really going to be interesting. And there's going to be smaller ones too. I mean, this is with four people. Now, you can imagine a smaller one. Now, you can imagine something the size of like a Suburban flying through the air. But, I mean, it's coming. These things are going to end up happening.
And then there's always going to be rednecks that are hot rodding them. They're changing the way they look.
I've got
a low rider one. I've got a jacked up one.
Yeah, exactly.
Got, you know,
mine will land in a swamp. Mine will land on the lake. In the event, yeah, it's going to happen. It's definitely going to happen.
That's pretty cool. Well, did you see this over here at The Guardian? There's an article recently written about how Egyptians were buried in recycled coffins.
Seriously?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Now, the article basically covers how new research that will be displayed in an exhibition that's opening next week at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge is going to be showing how numerous Egyptians were actually buried in new decorated coffins that were patched together from pieces of older coffins. It says the raw materials can only have been obtained by tomb robbers, who most likely would have removed the original occupants, whose families would have paid a large sum for the coffins, and then painted inscriptions promising a good afterlife. Now, most Egyptian tombs found by archaeologists have been robbed at some point. It had been assumed that these thieves were mostly targeting like gold jewelry and gemstones and other precious objects that were buried with the dead. But this new research shows that they might have been there for just the coffins themselves, not just the contents, or perhaps both. So, it's funny, these ancient undertakers, they were pretty slick. What they were doing is they were basically selling these ornate coffins to people for a large sum of money. Then later, they would go back, dig up the coffins, throw the corpses out, and then resell them again.
It makes sense, right?
And the family's never the wiser.
They're like, oh, that looked just like the one I saw a few years ago. I'll take that one, because that is the one you saw a few years ago.
And they're saying that they were taking... There would be like ornate inscriptions, and instead of recreating it, they would just like take that part of the coffin and, you know, put it into this new coffin. So they're even saving themselves the work of having to do all the painting. They were just reusing it. Now, of course, some of these coffins, they say, were personalized with elaborate inscriptions naming or praising the dead. In many cases, people would buy coffins years before their own death, and then later it would be altered to promote what their achievements were during their life. So you'd write on here, Cam Hale, you know, he had a podcast, he was an archer, he was a fisherman. They waited to the end before they did it. But they say that new evidence using X-rays and CT scans shows that many of the coffins were pieced together with many older parts from other coffins. Now, these two coffins that were donated to the museum.
Bunch of shysters even back then.
That's 100% right. Now, these coffins that were donated to the museum were some of the first objects in the Egyptian collection. And it was given by two members of the university back in 1822, just 6 years after the Fitzwilliam Museum was founded. These ingenious craftsmen literally left their mark. They said that researchers also revealed their finger and palm prints were smudged in wet varnish inside some of the lids. So their fingerprints are still there from all those thousands of years ago.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, but that's exactly right. They had figured out a business.
And that's right.
And they just probably, it's kind of like restocking a shelf. They're like, okay, we buried, you know, what is it, whatever their name is, 7 months ago. Now Let's go back and dig them up. And
like we always laugh about at a restaurant. You're like, if you don't eat all those rolls, they're going to take them in the back and just put them back in another basket and put them in the warmer. This
you
is what they were
do
doing.
That. They got to do that.
They got to do that, right? Like, oh, they didn't eat those rolls. Put those in that other basket. It'll be fine.
Yeah, they got to be doing good. That.
I would. I'm just saying. Well, I got this right here from the ITV report, and this reminded me of our friends down under in Australia is dealing with some problems. But what actually grabbed me was this: the headline said, Harry Panic as tumbleweed engulfs Australian homes. And I thought of Harry Panic. Was a girl that Kyle used to date. We didn't call her that till after a night skinny dipping, but anyhow, that's a whole nother story. But it says a fast-growing tumbleweed dubbed Harry Panic has taken over a street in rural Australian town with homes and gardens clogged with the weed.
I saw the pictures of it.
Did you see how crazy that looks?
Yeah.
It looks like it's not even real. It says residents in Wangaratta, Victoria have complained that they have to spend hours clearing away the weed only for it to come back the next day. They also say that extremely dry conditions and winds mean that the weed is engulfing these homes up to the roof height. That says one resident, Cheryl Legrand, said that she had spent 8 hours cleaning out the tumbleweed from her garden only for it to return the following day. It says the grass is found in every Australian state, but a nearby farmer is being blamed for the outbreak, accused of failing to tend it in his paddock. It says the weed, which is called hairy because of the long hairs along the edges of the leaves, can cause a potential fatal condition called a yellow big head in sheep if eaten in large quantities. Well, what is that, you ask? I looked into this. It says there's swelling around the head with a drooping of ears and swelling around the muzzle. Some of the eyes will be nearly completely shut due to the swelling, and there can be a yellowy discharge from the eyes. And also it comes with swollen lips, eyelids, and swelling of the entire head with a raw weeping muzzle. It says chronic cases developed skin necrosis, with ear tips curling up and lips becoming immobilized. Most of the sheep that have had it died in spite of antibiotic and anti-inflammatory treatment.
Because of this tumbleweeds?
They eat it, I guess, get into it, yeah. The whole thing. So, yeah, it's yellow big head. I know I got a big head, but it ain't yellow. It says Australian authorities, get a load of this. Now, look, I ain't talking bad about anybody's authorities, but this is kind of crappy. It says that they're unable to help with the cleanup because the tumbleweeds, made of dead grass and seeds, do not pose a fire threat. Now, I want to stop that right there, because last time I checked, dead grass burns real well.
Yeah, and if you see the pictures, I mean, it's like up to the chest on houses.
On
yeah.
People around there. All, and we're talking everywhere, folks. Like, it looks like it is a apocalyptic vision. So all it, one little fire gets loose, the whole town's engulfed in burning grass. But they're not going to help. They're like, they're fine.
Especially
they're
when good. We reminded of the birds that carry burning twigs and
exactly.
Drop
them. Right? Exactly. So yeah, you're like, thanks a lot, buddy. So anyway, everybody down in Australia down there, and we're thinking about you. Y'all be careful fighting off. It's not like you don't have like a deadly snakes and spiders and sharks to deal with. Now you got deadly grass coming into your house too.
Right.
Awesome.
Not bad enough. Well, check out this recent article posted by our friend Greg Newkirk over on his website, Who Forted. There's an interesting story about a strange grave of an Emily Isabella Burt, who is Georgia's real life werewolf.
Ooh.
Check this out. Now, in today's culture, Cam, with all the movies like Underworld, The Howling, Teen Wolf, or even the movie Twilight, everyone's familiar with werewolves. However, we easily forget that there was a period of time where the threat of a hungry werewolf lurking the countryside was considered a very real and deadly serious ordeal. Now, many parts of the world believe in werewolves or shapeshifters, and some still do. One place in particular was the state of Georgia during the mid-1800s. It sounds like a tall tale, but today you can still visit the creature's grave. The story begins with a young girl named Emily Isabel Burt. Now, Emily was the shyest and most reserved child of the wealthy Burt family, who were prominent members of town now known as Woodland. When Emily's father died, he left a hefty sum of money behind, and rather than spend her days looking after the children, Emily's mother, Mildred Owen Burt, shipped them off to boarding school in Europe, freeing her to spend her days chatting with other socialites. After a long semester in Europe, Emily returned home, and it wasn't long before the rest of her family started to notice that something about her wasn't quite right. She looked sickly, with a million-mile stare, and complained that she was unable to sleep. As the days wore on, her mother began to realize that Emily had been slipping off into the nearby forest in the middle of the night. When confronted, Emily claimed that she couldn't recall most of her midnight strolls. To make matters worse, she started to grow unsightly hair in odd places, and even strangers noticed that her teeth began to look more pointed, almost as if she were growing fangs. Mildred wrote the odd changes off as puberty and vowed to keep a closer eye on her daughter. At the same time, local farmers were dealing with some strange problems of their own. Throughout Talbot County, farmers were waking in the morning only to find their fields littered with the mangled carcasses of their livestock, seemingly victims of a wolf attack. Together, the farmers concocted a plan to end the slayings once and for all and started nightly hunting parties with the intention of capturing or killing the beast responsible. After weeks of failed attempts to slay the phantom wolf, the frustrated farmers resulted in their last resort. They asked the town weirdo for help. Locals always whispered about the strange old man. He was from Eastern Europe. Some claimed that he dabbled in black magic. Others said he was crazy. But either way, he was definitely an outsider. When the animal mutilations first began, no one listened when he told them that he knew which creature was to blame. According to him, it was no regular animal. It was a werewolf. With little else to go on and scores of dead animals to deal with, the farmers were finally ready to listen. They now knew that tracking the beast on any old night was a fruitless effort. They needed a new plan. The old man told them that what they needed to do was wait until the next full moon to resume their hunt. In the meantime, the old man instructed the farmers to take every silver crucifix they could find, melt them down, and use the metal to fashion bullets. As strange as his advice was, the farmers were out of options, so they did what they were told. Several weeks later, the group took to the fields by the light of the full moon, just as the old man had said. The hunting party came across a frightening silhouette lurking in the distance. The creature was as big as a man. It had a long snout, and it walked on two legs. As its wolf-like ears twitched in the moonlight, the hunting party raised their rifles, took aim, and stared at the monster. As the barrage of gunshots filled the night air, the werewolf let out a painful scream and fled into the forest. No one was sure where the creature was hit, but the old man's crazy plan had worked. Meanwhile, unbeknownst to the celebrating farmers, there was another hunt happening in the very same area. Mildred Owen Burt awoke to the sound of the gunshots, only to discover that her daughter Emily's bed was empty. Determined to get to the bottom of her daughter's secretive midnight adventures, she lit a lantern and headed into the forest. After searching high and low, Mildred stumbled onto Emily's unconscious body. A pool of blood surrounded her hand, and it appeared that she had been shot. Mildred did her best to stop the bleeding and ran for help. The following day, the local doctor patched up Emily's wounds, but even he couldn't explain what happened. After the rumors of Emily's accident, the farmers' successful werewolf hunt began to collide in the local taverns. Mildred discovered a doctor in Paris who claimed to specialize in lycanthropy. With the sneaking suspicion that Emily might have been to blame for the rash of animal mutilations, Mildred sent her off to Paris in hopes that she might be cured. According to all the legends, the attacks completely ceased from then on. Several years later, Emily Isabella Burt returned to Georgia, cured of her mysterious ailments, and lived out the rest of her life as a successful businesswoman and landlord. In 1911, at the age of 70, Isabella died and was buried in the Owens and Holmes Cemetery in Talbot County. Now, many people say this is all urban legend, and others claim that it's completely and absolutely the truth. Many locals even claim that their grandparents saw the beast or were members of that hunting party. There are still tales today. You can sometimes see the ghostly spirit of Emily Isabella Burt still roaming the countryside by the light of the moon, in werewolf form, of course. And you can go and visit her gravesite today in Woodland, Georgia. So that's an odd tale, right?
Speaking of Harry Panic, that's a heck of an odd tale.
Right, and they say you can still visit the grave today. I mean, she really was a real person, and this is the folklore and legends and the stories about her life from that area. So what the heck is that? I mean, it sounds like a Hollywood movie script.
It does. And that's probably how a lot of those stories got started. It's like we always talk about. That's how a lot of that stuff gets going.
The movies were taken from these actual stories, yeah.
I mean, like the folklore of a lot of these stories and stuff that we cover, too, is a lot of it is maybe it is something that's not quite as crazy as what it sounds like, but it builds and builds and builds because it's unexplained. People can't explain some of those things.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool story. Let's take a break, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. I like those stories, the folklore. I love the every region, you know, no matter where you're at on the globe, seems to have their own stories of these crazy things that have happened, and that's one of my favorite things about the show. But speaking of the show, we often ask everyone if you have any interesting stories or articles you'd like to share with Expanded Perspectives, please pass them along. And I don't know what happened. I don't know what's been happening. I don't know if it was featured, but this is not a new story. In fact, I think this is all the way back from like 1997. Mm-hmm. But in the last 3 weeks, without exaggeration, probably gotten 115 emails all asking us to do the same topic.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's going on. I must have missed it. There must have been something.
I totally missed it, yeah.
You know, like when there were the Flat Earth stuff. That's because the rapper B.O.B. or whatever.
Yeah.
So that started a resurgence in the Flat Earth, you know, talks.
Mm-hmm.
There's no debate in my mind, but anyways,
it sparked
a lot of that. But recently, there must have been something that I'm just not aware of that sparked this interest in Mel's Hole. I remember reading about Mel's Hole probably about 3 or 4 years ago. And to be honest, I never really looked into it.
Glanced over it.
I was like, I don't understand. It doesn't seem like much to me. It's just probably an entrance to a cavern. I mean, we know caverns exist.
Yeah.
They found a cavern not too long ago when they were building some roads here. And I know when they put the interstate in years ago, they found another cavern, you know, just by San Antonio. But, you know, that kind of stuff happens. You see these sinkholes that open up in Florida? Have you seen the ones like in Colombia or Costa Rica? I don't remember where that huge one is. But this happens from time to time. So that's what I thought it was. This is just, it's an entrance to a cavern. What's the big deal? But with everybody telling us and asking us to do the stories, I was like, all right, well, let me revisit this. And I called Cam, and he was like, man, there's a lot to this story. And so that's what we're going to get into today. It's a very interesting story. Some of it sounds completely crazy, but then there's other things that kind of substantiate the claims. So then you're like, man, I don't know. Very interesting.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about this?
Like you said, before we go any further, look, we're all going to be on this ride together. We don't know if this is a complete and total hoax, if this is real, if it's 50-50, 60-40. We have any idea. So let's all just get together and let's just agree that this is going to be an interesting story, to say the least. And this is all we're going to do is tell this story, because it is, it's very, very fascinating, and it's kind of unsettling in certain parts. But to start off, this is what we kind of gathered up. And if you do some listening to, you can find online the actual interviews of when it all came down. But I'm going to just throw this out there to give you an overview of what Mel, or who Mel was, real quick. Is from what we gather, Mel looks like Willie Nelson. So you got a picture in your mind, Willie Nelson telling you this story. Now, during the interview, he actually swears that he's like, I swear on the Bible that this story is true. All right. He also, Mel had a wife, talks about, and he also talks about that he had a hobby of making belt buckles that he would sell at flea markets and things like that.
Right.
So with those little tidbits, we're going to get into the story. So kind of keep this kind of guy in mind. Now, it took place on Art Bell's Coast to Coast back in 1997 is when this went down. And the story goes that he had actually received a fax from a fella named Mel Waters. Before we go any further, people have done some looking into. They can't find any person by the name of Mel Waters even listed as living in this area. So we're not even sure if that's the person's real name, but we're going to use it for what it is. So the facts basically explained that Mel had what he thought was a bottomless pit on his property in an area there near Manistash, Washington. And that's where this picks up. So Art, of course, contacted him, had Mel come on his show and explain all of this stuff in an interview.
When did you discover this hole?
Well, the hole has always been there. We've been out there for a couple of years now, and the hole has been there since we've been there. It's been there since the previous owner was there, and the previous owner there was quite elderly, and I'd say he was there for a good 30, 40 years before we moved in.
Wow.
And then
so there's been a thing of throwing stuff down this hole for a long time.
It's been going on, for as long as the hole has been there, I assume.
When nobody knows that, I guess. All right, how do you pronounce the name of your town?
And of course, it got dubbed Mel's Hole. Now, at the time of the very first interview, Mel was not at his house. He was in a town in Washington called Ellensburg. So he's sitting in Ellensburg. He's not there. So I don't know why he may have left his home to go do this. Who knows? But story goes at this, that Mel had purchased this property several years earlier, and that the previous owner had actually been in charge of the land, on the land, for over 30 years prior to that. So when Mel found all this, he went to asking the people around. Well, all of his neighbors knew of the hole and the story behind it quite well. And they even said that they would carry garbage or, just pretty much scrap or anything like hauling off. Like people have laying around their barns and out in old fields. They'd gather it up and come throw it in the hole. They didn't think anything of it. So you got to picture this. There's a round hole. It's got a little stone retaining wall that goes right around it. Now, this wall seems to have been there, but it says, and it goes down the wall about 15 feet below the surface. Now, beyond this wall, there's this big, dark hole that was right through the dirt, right through the bedrock, just darkness. And like I said, Mel said everybody that he talked to, nobody has any recollection of that hole not being there. It had always been there for as long as they have known. Now, when I'm telling you the size of this hole, it's 9 feet wide. From edge to edge, we've got a 9-foot hole here. Now, during this whole thing, there seemed to be no other reason to indicate that this pit had any bottom either. Like I said, they said no matter what you threw into this hole, you could never hear it hit. There was no splash, no crashing sound, no noise echo even back out of the hole when they yelled or anything in it. Nothing. There were some other strange things around this hole that animals feared it. Now, Mel said that his dogs would go anywhere. His dogs were his best friends, loyal to no end, but they would never get near the hole. And even if he himself attempted to pull them on a leash, take them there, they'd set back. They're digging, they're clawing. They didn't want no part of that hole at all. Nothing. And not just that, but no one around there, no one's pets, no animals of the wild, nothing would go near that hole. Now, that being said, do the animals just have an innate sense that that's danger? You go in those things, you fall in. They don't get anywhere near them. They don't take a chance.
Yeah, just unless you're a lemming.
Yeah.
I mean, most animals don't get near the cliffs.
Or is there something that it radiates, it emanates, that's not right? Are they hearing something? Are they picking up on a vibrational buzz? We don't really know. Well, part of the story that's really interesting, too, that Mel told was about one of his neighbors. And it seems his neighbor was a hunter, and he had hunting dogs. And his favorite hunting dog had died, so he decided to dispose of this animal in the pit.
Right.
So he carries the dog over there, you know, and all that, and pitches him in there. And said not long later, after that, probably, you know, a year or so later, he swears he saw the exact same dog with the exact same collar running around in the woods. Just running around, just like it's playing over there. That's what the neighbor swears that he saw, is the dog he threw in the pit. So he's like, you know, Pet Cemetery is what it made me think.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Well, so Mel, having this place on his property, like most of you would be, the same as any of us, was like, let's start messing around with it. Let's see if we can find out how deep this thing is.
You know, I got this thinking one day, how come this hole is not filling up? It must be an awfully deep hole.
That's a good thing to consider, sure, as you throw stuff in it for decades, literally.
And so, you know, I used to be I would say pretty close to a professional shark fisherman. So I had a couple of huge fishing reels, went out there and started letting the line down. I figure after one...
Did you weight the line?
Oh, yeah. There's in fact, the original line is still down there. I have just been adding to the line and keeping track of how much line I have used. So I've not reeled it in.
How much weight is on it?
There's a one-pound weight at the bottom of it.
One-pound weight, all right.
One-pound weight. It's a triangular one-pound weight.
Okay.
And so that's at the bottom of it. At first...
So in other words, it would go down kind of like a plumb bob.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, I have it rigged across the center of it there.
And the story goes, he was a fisherman. He liked to fish for sharks and things like that. So he had a lot of fishing line, a lot of fishing equipment. So he sets it all up. I'm picturing, you know, outriggers. He's got his rod holders and all that. And he had enough for 1,500 feet of line. That's what he had. So
right.
I'm picturing like huge ocean reels is what I'm thinking, you know. So he's like, well, how can I find out if there's any water in this? So he came up with an idea. He's like, I'm going to get some candy. And said, you know, in theory, he's going to let this candy, if he lowers it down in there and the candy dissolves and he knows there's water down in there. So he got lifesavers. So he's like, I'll tie the lifesaver on the end of this fishing line, probably put some weight above it, and I'm going to lower this thing down in there. He lowered it all the way out to 1,500 feet, brought it back up. Nothing had happened to it. No water. So 1,500 feet down of line, there's no water. So he's like, So the next thing, he's like, this is what I'll do. I'll put a one-pound lead weight and lower it down in there. And then he said when it's the end of the spool, of that 1,500, he's going to tie another spool of 1,500 feet, and he's going to keep lowering it to see how far down he gets it to go.
Right.
Story goes that he used 80,000 feet of fishing line, or over 15 miles worth, is the story that he tells. Is every time
Holy
he would lower
cow.
It, he would tie on more, and keep going, and keep going, and keep going, and keep going.
Well, you've got miles and miles of...
I'm measuring it by feet. You know, I convert feet to yards, so I don't know
sure.
how many miles that is. I assume it's a fair number of miles, though.
Well, 5,280 feet is a mile. So you really think you've got 80,000?
Yes. Yeah. I get line in 5,000-yard spools, and so I've gone through that many.
Well, you have got a hole then that goes. Well, you know, you can't say to the center of the earth, but you've got a hole that goes miles and miles and miles into the earth. I would think a university would be out there, boom, just like that.
Well, my wife does work for a local university.
And 15 miles?
15, that's the story that he tells is 15 miles. Well, of course, you can only imagine all the coast-to-coast listeners were going crazy, right?
Yeah.
And so they start calling in. They're trying to give him, you know, some ideas of what he needs to do. Let's do this. Let's do that. I mean... People even said that they figured by that under physics that the line should have snapped. That there's a point where the line itself can't hold its own weight once it gets so far out there, much less having a one-pound weight on the end of it. You follow me?
I do.
And they said, well, it should have untied. It should have come loose, the whole thing. So I have no idea. You know,
I just
the whole
was
deal.
Looking while you were saying the center of the earth, in case you were wondering, is about 4,000 miles from the earth to the core.
Well, that's if it's round.
Oh.
So it says one suggested using, of course, weighing the fishing line and then dividing the value of the weight by the single foot of line. And the other said use a radar to try to do it, you know, to find out how far it is. Well, then, of course, Art comes back on. And like you said, you can listen to the interviews. You can find them online and hear.
I'll put them in the show notes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, he goes, why don't you get a volunteer? Is what Art said. Lower them down in there. And Mel's like, man, I don't know. What if there's dangerous gases down in there? What if, you know, there's things we don't have any idea what are we going to do? You know, and then, of course, people start volunteering, and it was like, I'll go. This whole thing, during that whole thing, kind of unravels. But Mel was like, look, man, you don't want to be lowered down there. What if the rope breaks? You never know what's going to happen. You know, it's everybody's a big tough guy till it comes time to do tough guy stuff. And then you're kind of like, wait a second.
Right. Yeah, that'd be pretty scary. Hey, Cam, I'm down here in Mel's hole trying to get my hair to grow back. Hello? Hey, anybody out there? Pretty deep in this hole. All right, sorry.
Pretty deep in this hole. Well, here's the cool thing is Art even asked Mel in the interview. He's like, if you contracted a terminal illness, would you just jump off in the pit? And Mel actually said that when he passes away, that he had in his will to have his body disposed of in the pit.
Really?
Yeah, that's what he claims. And then Art comes up with some stuff about, you know, having him dispose of like radioactive waste, like the government. Why don't you let the government do that?
Yeah,
it's bottomless. And then, but of course, they don't know about still the whole water thing. What if you're hitting a water table? You can't throw stuff down in there. Mel even claimed in one part of the interview that he had thrown a vacuum tube out of an old television because he was wanting to hear it go boom when it hit the bottom. Yeah. He knew and all that stuff. Well, he never did. And then Art's like, look, you can't be saying that on the air because, you know, you could be polluting the water. And Mel's like, man, there's no water. We've done checked on all this stuff. Well, so that made it really fun, you know, and everybody's like, that was a great interview, this whole thing and this whole deal. And nobody really knows. Well, that's only the tip of the iceberg in this story, basically, that sounds like the ramblings of an eccentric-minded madman. But if you into that kind of stuff, which we are, we're going to go a little bit deeper. Now, allegedly, this is all some alleged stuff, that the day after the broadcast that Mel returned home, because, you know, like I said before, he wasn't home. He was in another town in Washington.
Or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And the story claims that there was, like, uniformed people there that told Mel that there was a plane crash and he couldn't even go on his own property at the time, that they had to hold him out. Now, Mel says he's like he didn't believe any of that because he couldn't see smoke. He couldn't see like any emergency vehicles, none of that stuff. And so he, you know, got the whole thing. He also at the time threatened to go to the press. He's like, look, I'm fixing to go and tell everybody and all that stuff. They kind of put the stops on that because they said, hey, we want to lease the property from you. This is his story for $250,000 per month. Well, of course, the Mel's like, well, hell yeah, you know, 250, yeah, let's have this stuff. Story goes again that Mel moved to Australia and had help from these people, whoever these people were, these uniformed people were. We're all under the assumption it was probably the government. So the story goes that Mel had moved and all this. The story also goes that Art Bell confirmed the relocation of Mel Waters and that he was living in Australia. The story also goes, now Mel was a big farmer. He loved growing herbs, and if you read into it, it says medicinal herbs. So we're assuming Mel may have, you know, partaken a little bit of the devil's lettuce, the marijuana, and he may have taken some of this with him too, because it says in some of the stories that the people in Australia or whoever it was, these people that were helping him, actually let him bring his dogs and some of his plants into Australia, which doesn't sound like anything of any reality, basically. But the story also goes, Mel claims that they paid him regularly and on time every month between March of 97 to December of 99. Now, here's what's pretty wild. Mel loved wombats. So the story goes even crazier there, that he actually started a rescue and research area there and spent a lot of his money on it there in Australia. But he returned home in December of 99. He wanted to see some family. And sure enough, it was going to appear on Coast to Coast again. He tells that the government actually served him with some legal papers and that this actually implicated him in a violation of building codes on his property and that they seized his land.
Hmm?
Yeah, that's the way the story goes. Well, he apparently came home, he helped his nephew move, and then Mel got on a bus in Tacoma and was headed to Olympia, okay? They're in Washington. Apparently there was an altercation, as the story goes, on this bus, and the police asked Mel to give a statement. Mel's like, no. That he had to get back to Olympia. And the police said that they could give him a ride in a van. Now, this is Mel's story, and that was the last thing that he remembers. 12 days later, Mel wakes in an alley in San Francisco, had the hell beaten out of him, had teeth knocked out, and they said there was some evidence on his arms that he'd actually been hooked up to an IV, and Mel was wearing his homemade belt buckle, and that it was stolen.
Really?
Yeah, that's what was missing. Also, too, the story goes that what he had started over in Australia had been completely dismantled Everybody had been fired, his employees let go. So you're like, what the heck's going on? So he goes back to Washington with his nephew and goes back on Art's show to start telling. Now we start talking about this belt buckle because he ends up tracking down a man who had bought one of Mel's belt buckles because of these coins. Mel tells a story that he had found some coins, ended up being dimes, in like a Chinese envelope that was apparently old dimes from the 40s. And he said that he noticed that on one of these dimes, it was minted in 1943, that even though there were no dimes in 43, the story goes, that had Roosevelt's face on it. And he said every American coin is marked with a letter, of course, that indicates where it was minted, and that this dime was marked with a B. And there's no city that's ever minted U.S. currency has ever begun with the letter B.
Mm-hmm.
So the owner of this belt buckle, whom he tracked down, brought this coin that was in it to a coin dealer. And the dealer himself had no idea what was going on. He's like, I've never seen that. But he said, I would like to buy it from you. And the man's like, let me think about it. This whole, I don't really know if I want to sell this dime yet. Story again goes that the U.S. Treasury Department shows up at this man's house to take the dime from him. Now, in this part of the story, Richard C. Hoagland's name pops up because he had actually made a statement about that. Is what if this dime came from a parallel universe?
Well, that's an idea.
You know what I mean? What if this is something, and that's the reason they're like, wait a second, this isn't a dime. None of these have ever been made. They don't have any idea where this comes from. So you're like, this is getting even crazier. Well, it gets even crazier, folks. It gets even wilder. At one point in one of the interviews, he asks Art Bell if he had ever heard of anything called a Terra server. The Terra server is what Mel said is a database that had aerial imagery and satellite imagery of public domain areas.
Okay, kind of like Google Earth.
You've got them at. This was actually made available online in December of 97, almost a year after Mel first appeared on Art's show. You know, so Mel, he was on there in 97. So you got a 7-8 months later, then that's when it was made available, this satellite imagery. So you got to think about it. Now, Google Earth, I believe, is like in 02, whenever that stuff came out, something like that's when Google Earth started. But anyhow, people said, Mel comes on, starts talking about this Terra server, and he said, if you find any of these pictures, aerial, of the area that I'm talking about, it's redacted. There'll be like, it's covered up. You can't see it. It's been pulled down. Well, sure enough, they were some of the listeners, got on and got to digging around and found these pictures. And you can find them online of the old pictures from then of where Mel was talking about, and there's a big white block there. Now, it could have been Photoshop. People could have uploaded it just to make more of the story seem real. I don't know. I have no idea. We're just going off the way the story is told. That the images showed that they had been tampered with, and this area that Mel was speaking of that had the hole is gone. Mm. It's just missing. Now, Mel had heard of some locals in this area that said that they had actually seen coming out of that hole black anti-light. So you're like, what the heck? And then he even had a friend of his that was a truck driver, said that he had delivered large crates of fiber optic equipment to a group of what he said was Israelis in a warehouse there in Ellensburg. And he had another trucker buddy of his that said he delivered scientific instruments to the same warehouse. And there was a scientific lab there in San Francisco that does research for the military that was in that warehouse that was getting that scientific instrument. So it's kind of like, wait a minute, it's just a big conspiracy. They're all working together. Why is, and then all of a sudden, you know, Mel gets gathered up, and when they find him, he's dumped in an alley in San Francisco. So it starts making you start... You start adding stuff up. Wait a second. Supposedly that this land was taken over by uniformed people. They paid Mel money to go away. Mel comes back, gets in a little altercation with these people. They snatch him up. He goes missing. Comes back. He wakes up. He's all the way across the country. Just so happens he wakes up in the town that this large scientific facility that does research for the military is actually in.
The Illuminati.
It starts looking kind of weird. You're like, first of all, if y'all haven't picked up on it already, the story, in order to make up one of these stories, would take a lot of work. This is a lot of work to get into. So then after listening to the show, there was a group of Native Americans there in Nevada, and they reached out to contact Mel, and they're like, hey, we want to talk to you. You know, we're big into medicinal plants. We're big into the same stuff you're in. And just so you know, we know of a place that there's a hole here in Nevada too. So Mel goes to them. Story goes, Mel goes down there, and they start discussing the type of plants that grew around the hole where he used to live, and then they showed him that same area where the hole, they're talking about the same kind of plants grow.
This is another hole.
Another hole, yes. So now's when it takes a really wild twist, because in the area where this hole is, it's inhabited by a group of Basque settlers, or Basque, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that they'd been there since the 1800s, these settlers have been. So they've moved over here from Europe over to the States. Well, they all get with Mel, and they're like, come here, we're going to show you the hole first and, you know, in person. So they take them there. This hole is in the middle of a very small village, and it's on public land where these families, these Basque families, had settled. Now, of course, the Basque are sheep farmers and sheep herders and stuff over in the Europeans, so they're doing the same thing here in Nevada, raising sheep. Now, they say that this hole had been there at least as long as them, so that's in the 1800s, so it was there when they got there, this hole. And they considered it like a spiritual area. They considered it more like a religious area of, you know, things that happened right there. Now, much like Mel's hole, this pit is 9 foot wide also, but there's a difference. This one has a metal ring, but it's solid, like a little solid metal wall, like a little fence around it, instead of the stone retaining wall like we talked about. Here's another crazy thing. It has a metal lining that goes down into that hole as far as the eye can see.
Wait, what now?
So it looks like it's been slip lined with metal. So it's almost like you took you got to imagine if you buried a Pringles can in the sand and only left a little of it sticking up.
Yeah.
That'd be your little wall, and you can look, and then it's still lined all the way down. So it looks like it's got a metal lining in this pit all the way down. It's not rock. It's metal.
So this is man-made.
It looks either the hole's man-made or what's been lined with it is man-made. Yeah, but it looks like it's something strange. We're just now getting into the strange part, folks. They said that the metal rim produced a field of warmth, though not really heat like we know it. It was just a warm thing. Also, they said the really interesting thing about this hole was it had sound-canceling properties. Now, unlike Mel's original hole, where nothing could be heard hitting the bottom, you know, they throw stuff in it, all this stuff, nothing could be heard. This hole, this new one that the Basques had, would cancel out any kind of sound of anything even directly above it. So they said that the story goes that if you walked up and hit the metal rim with an object, say you took a wrench and you hit that metal,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't produce any sound. Just dead. How crazy is that, right? Also, too, animals, too, were terrified of this place. And they had seen black beams, had seen, not beings, beams, like anti-light coming out of this. Just like people said they'd witnessed around there, around Mel's hole. So, like any good, you know, researcher, redneck, and madman would do, Mel and his Basque villager friends there decided, hey, let's do an experiment. So listen to this first experiment that they did. What they did is they got a bucket of just regular ice. They went to the store, went to town, whatever, got them a big bucket of ice. And they're going to put a bucket of ice on a rope. They're going to lower it down in the pit as far as they could. While on the other time, they had two buckets. They took another bucket of ice, and they left it right there beside the pit because mm-hmm. they wanted that as their control bucket. So they wanted to see about the melt rate, okay? Now, it's funny, 1,500 feet come up in this one, too. So I guess that's the going route. Maybe Mel brought his gear. I don't know. So everybody's got 1,500 feet to lower into this hole. So they lower it down into the hole. They wait till the ice is halfway melted, the control ice up there with them. So they can know, okay, this is halfway melted bucket of ice. Pull that up out of the hole. Let's see what it is. So they pull it up. So they want to see. They're going to compare the two. The ice in the pit did not melt. Okay, at all.
Well, maybe because it was cold down there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But here's what even gets crazier. The strangest thing is it was lukewarm, but crazier that it continued to remain solid, Kyle, what they pulled out of there. Mel even grabbed a piece out of the bucket and held it in his hands, and it still wasn't melting. It was lukewarm, the ice was, without melting. So the whole group got together, they said, all right, look, let's build us a fire. They built a fire. They got some stuff. Little pots and pans. They said, we're going to melt this ice down. So they cooked ice over the fire pit to melt it. It wouldn't melt. Now, this was regular ice they lowered in this bucket.
Just from lowering it in the hole,
they said it would not melt. The story even goes on that the lukewarm ice, as they called it, caught on fire and was producing heat off of itself. They said not like yellow flame, like large, you just see like burning on wood. They said more like a little flicker, like a little flashing flicker, like just the whole, like if you just had a little bitty fire that you could barely see was coming off of, almost like coals, that's burning. Now, Mel said that the bucket of ice continued to burn on for several months, and that during the interview, he even speculated that it's probably still burning in the moment I'm doing this interview. Now, he said that one of the fellas there took some of this burning ice and took it home and put it in his stove. and that it's been keeping his cabin warm through the entire winter.
What?
Yeah, now that's it. Now, they said that they went on to repeat this bucket experiments, but it only worked about a third of the time, and they got mixed results trying the exact same experiment. So, of course, like they did on the last one, what ends up happening, Mel tells that one of the Basques decided that he wanted to be lowered into the hole himself. Well, you got to imagine they all freak. They're like, look, dude, look what happened to the ice. We're not putting you in the hole. You know, it's just not happening. This isn't going down. So, as you know, this is Mel telling him all the stuff. He's like, so they talk him out of it. And so what they come up with is another idea here, another great idea. So instead of lowering him into the pit, they decide to lower a sheep into the pit. Now, I picture one of the most famous last word sequences of hold my beer and watch this taking place around this pit. Now, I was thinking booze and unsolved mysteries go hand in hand is what I can see. So that's I picture guys drinking beer or vino or whatever they got. They're like, we're going to figure this out. Now, as terrible as it sounds, the story goes that they grabbed a sheep and headed to the hole with it. But the sheep wasn't having it. Okay.
Right.
It was kicking. It was screaming. It was panicking. And like all animals ever seen in proximity of this entire hole, it refused to go near the opening. Now, much like the remark Morgan Freeman makes in the movie The Shawshank Redemption, when the sisters are about to have their way with Andy Dufresne.
Right.
I would love to tell y'all that the sheep fought the good fight and the Basques let it go, but that wouldn't be the truth.
No, it didn't happen that way?
The Basques were a very determined folk. So they cracked the sheep on the forehead right between the eyes, knocked it out enough that they could cram it in a crate. And with a cable attached to the top so they could easily lower it into there, they swung it out over the hull. Well, now you got to imagine, now poor Mr. Sheep, he comes to. And just before they got it to the hull, and much of the way I'm sure I would be acting in a shark cage being lowered into the ocean, this sheep went berserk inside this crate, knowing, I'm sure, what's about to happen. They said it let out a blood-curdling lamb scream that led the people involved to feel as if it knew exactly what was about to happen to it. Now, they said once the crate was hoisted directly over the pit, all the noise stopped. You couldn't hear anything. Now, they said you could still see the box violently shaking on the end of that rope as it's hanging over the hole, but there was no sound coming from it, which is strange. It's a noise canceling coming up out of there. Now, the men lowered the sheep, and it continued to struggle, of course, in that crate, going crazy until they said about halfway down. Then there was no more movement at all on the end of the rope. Nothing. They lowered it to the end of the 1,500 feet. Now, Mel and the villagers say that they felt a strange and fuzzy vibration in this metal rim. Now, of course, the group left good old Mr. Sheep down there below for a half an hour. And then, of course, they show back up to the hoist. They task bringing it back to the top, and they pull it back to the top. They said the first thing that they noticed, all of them noticed, was that now there was definitely no longer movement coming from that crate. Nothing. Everything looked good from the outside of the box. But the inside, of course, poor old Mr. Sheep was now dead. Now, they get it out, and it looks like a perfectly normal sheep on the outside. So a Basque butcher says, you know what, I think I'm going to dissect this animal on this nearby table here. I'm going to open it up. We're going to see what happened to it, if anything happened to it.
Right, okay.
Now, y'all buckle up, because if this story wasn't strange and crazy enough, well, we just turned the volume up to 11 here. Shift it up into overdrive, drop the hammer, whatever, because now this story takes a hell of a turn, okay? You see, inside, it looked like the sheep had been cooked. Now, the group noticed a strange-type gel they said that was surrounding an enormous tumor that was growing inside the sheep. They removed the tumor, and so they noticed that it appeared to be moving like a pulsing, fleshy sack. Now, the Basque butcher cut open this tumor and, hope y'all are ready for this, Hervé Villechaize popped out. No, I'm kidding. Not Hervé Villechaize. I'm joking. It was something a whole lot worse. The story goes that a fleshy creature emerged from a slimy flesh sack and that it looked like an 18-inch long cross between a fetus and a seal with flippers and all. Yeah, you heard me right. There is an 18-inch half-human, half-seal, crazy creature fetus flipper with human eyes alive and connected to this tumor with an umbilical cord, crawls out of this nasty sack that they're looking at after they've just come out of this sheep after they've lowered it down in this hole.
Okay.
Yeah. You heard me right. Yeah. Now, Mel says this, that the creature disconnected itself from the cord and it gave him a feeling of being in the presence of a miracle when he was standing there. Now, one of the men, of course, like any rational human being, said, let's kill the sucker quickly. Let's get rid of this thing. They said the creature crawled to the edge of the table and looked up at Mel. And Mel says he somehow felt connected to it. He felt very compelled to pick it up. So he scoops it up and lays it on the ground. Now, they said the slime that was on Mel's hands smelled like fresh ozone, like the ozone smell, like the crackling of the electricity. He said it smelled like ozone. He said, and as the creature lay there on its belly, said all the men were standing around there, said it looked up at him. And it started studying each one of them, you know, eye contact to eye contact, taking turns. And they said, as though, Mel says, as it had some sort of intelligence. So the crazy thing was that they all stood there staring at this thing for about 2 hours.
I can imagine.
They said they were all hypnotized. They were all standing, no sound, just staring at it. Now, Mel said in the interview that the gaze of this thing was the most compassionate look that he's ever witnessed, looking into its eyes. Now, the creature makes its way towards the hole. Mel again said he felt compelled to help it out, so he picks it up and he sets it on top of the metal rim. Says the creature then looks back at all the men, gives a little slow 50-cent head nod, of course, turns around and just, choop, jumps back off in the hole. Yeah.
What?
All the witnesses there.
And this is not at Mel's hole. This is at the other hole.
This is at the other hole in Nevada. Yeah,
okay.
Mel says that all the witnesses there were just completely wiped out. You know, boom, they're done. They grabbed the remains of that sheep, throw it back in the hole. Now, Mel went on to claim that, of course, in late August, prior to going to Nevada, that he had actually been diagnosed with esophageal cancer, lethal esophageal cancer, that they had given him 6 months to live. This is another part of the story, that he says that when he comes back home after doing this and touching this creature and all this, that it's gone. There's no more cancer. He's totally cancer-free. He thinks this creature took it from him, all right, which is wild enough. So, okay. So Mel says that there's one of the Basque elders there, and that he had always believed this thing to be spiritual, you know, and that this hole was, and that he had not even seemed surprised at all about this creature being there. So before Mel leaves and before this old man goes away and all this stuff, he gives Mel something. He said, put this in your pocket. This is an object that I want you to have. So Mel puts it in his pocket.
Right.
Goes on. He said, he don't think nothing at it. Later on, he pulls it out. He looks at it. It's a 1943 Roosevelt dime. Which is funny because that's the same kind of stuff we were talking about further that Mel claims that he had found before that had this dime with the B on it, right?
Uh-huh.
So you fast forward to 2002, and then Mel comes back on again for another little update, right? So he starts talking about this, that after all this happened in Nevada, he said that helicopters started flying over the village on routine basis, and that he also informed that the metallic collar that was around this hole is invisible. So now it can become invisible. And said, when you reach a certain distance away, it completely goes away. Like you can't. So it keeps people from being able to see the hole unless you know where the hole's at.
Right.
The story also goes, Mel tells, that this dime does the same thing, that it won't be picked up by any digital scanner. It won't show up on film. And that about 15 foot away, it'll disappear. You got it laying out on stuff. Okay.
Right.
He also tells a strange story, too, about the man that was using the ice to heat up his stove.
Yeah.
Well, apparently, the guy in the house said he was always thirsty, that the air was always dry, said his skin gets real dry, said he would even take a kettle of water. He'd take a pot of water, put it on top of the stove to try to help keep some humidity going. And he said that's when he noticed that above the stove, there was always like a lingering steam cloud above where that ice was cooking, right?
Okay.
Couldn't really figure all that stuff out. So he comes home one day, and the stove had crashed through the floorboards of the cabin, and he said was sunk about a foot down in the ground. So the guy's like, what the hell is going on here? So you got to imagine, it's cold. He don't know what to do. He's just got this burning ice inside a stove. So the story goes that he gets him some more stove pipe, rigs it all up, and just leaves it to where it's at. He's like, man, that's it. We're going to keep rocking the way we're rocking. Goes again. Apparently the guy returns after he's been gone just a couple weeks later, comes back home. They said the whole cabin is now just a pile of dry wood dust and ash. It's not burnt. It's just gotten so dry it's crumbled like sawdust.
Right.
So the story goes, he leaves it behind, moves in with some of his brothers. He comes back several months later. He finds that this same stove full of ice is 5 foot in the ground, and that its glassy, smooth surface to the hole is creating all around the edge of this hole. So the dude freaks out. Mel says, gets a hold of him. Mel says, all right, you know, I'm going to contact those people that I come in contact with. It's Mel's story. The people that took my land, the people that may have beaten me up, the people that may have pulled my teeth and left me for dead in San Francisco and all that helped me move to Australia, do all this. I'm going to get in touch with those guys again. He gets in touch with them. The man that owns the cabin, all that stuff, he's hiding. He wants to see what's going on. Story goes that there was a whole big group of people, whether it was military or who it was, show up with some bunch of construction equipment. They get cranes. They start doing all kinds of stuff, multiple cranes trying to lift this stove. One stove.
Right.
It takes multiple cranes to pick this whole thing up. They have to drop some chains in the ground. They got to pour water on all this. That goes on. The story says that it was one of the biggest trucks that he had ever seen. They hoist it up out of the ground, stick it in this big truck, pack it up, and haul it off. Mel goes on to say that ever since all this stuff has happened, that he feels like he's been followed his rest of his life, that people are always, and he said people always want to talk, or they end up finding him through stuff, even though no matter how much he tries to hide, somebody always seems to know.
Right.
So he's being followed because he's dealing with all this. At least that's the story he tells. Well, the Basques go on and they contact Mel again. And they said, just so you know, that little creature that crawled out of that sheep has been coming back. He comes back up and talks to us. They said they even found a way to talk to him, that it speaks through their radio, through the pulses in their radio. He says that they've tried to record some of this, but it just doesn't come up as like pulsating tones. It doesn't come up as any real language. Now, people theorize, and Mel was one of them, that he believed that this creature could be a what was called a rock flyer, which, you know, Native Americans, they believe that it lives under the ground, travels between different dimensions, basically, in the ground. Here's pretty wild, though, is the creature actually warned the people there about the burning ice and said that it can and would destroy the world in a very short amount of time if used improperly. Yeah. And they also tells them that greedy and undisciplined use of the ice would really cause a problem, that you could anticipate that being a real issue. And also, too, they go on to say that the creature says that there are intelligent beings on other worlds who anticipate that the human race will destroy itself through nuclear war, and they plan to move in once we're gone and use the ice on this planet. And then, of course, Mel is told that the burning ice is discovered in the universe and that it's always improperly used. And that was the last interview. That's where he kind of wrapped all this up. And since then, nobody's heard from him. Nobody's heard a word out of him. So I went on there and I got to looking around in the Midnight in the Desert website. Now, this comes from August 11th of 2015. There was a guy named Aaron S., and he posted this on the website with some pictures. And it says, Mel's hole is not setting out in an isolated region of the Manistash Ridge. It is being guarded by a closely knit group of locals. Also, the actual hole location is towards the bottom of the Terra Server white box alluded to in the 2002 show, down in Venus Valley. The fiber optic cable, however, was not used for the hole. They are actually running fiber optic cable all along the Upton Road from Ellsberg to the Venus Valley, probably for all the houses that have been built in the area since the story took place. It says at least four of the houses in the area have a direct view of the hole location, which is separated from cow pastures by a heavy-duty electrical fence. The fence appears to be protecting nothing but the hole itself. In one of the pictures I took of the hole, a bird was flying directly overhead. This made me think back to what Mel said of birds not sitting on the retaining wall or the metal grate. I, for one, am done messing with the hole, as two of the tires on my rental Jeep Grand Cherokee mysteriously went flat near the area of the hole. Also, there were some hideously malformed trees, dead trees, in that area. He said, chasing this woohoo cost me money, but I still feel it's worth it and would pursue it further if I could afford it. Aaron S.
What?
So that's the story, folks, of Mel's hole.
It's crazy.
Well, it seems like the story is even more fantastical away from Mel's hole. And what, look, I don't know if any of this is real, and that's what we talked to about. And we're not here to tell y'all if it's real. We're just here to cover it and make a fun story. But I can't help but think of this. It sure is wild to me that none of this wild stuff happened at the hole that people know exactly where it's at. It only happened at the hole that only Mel knows where it's at.
Yeah, that's true, right?
It does seem awful convenient that this guy can find Mel's hole there in Washington, but this one in Nevada with the Basques, nobody knows where it's at but us and the Basques. That's it. And that's where the alien comes from. That's where all this other wild stuff comes from. You're like, come on now. It just seems awful convenient for me. I want to hang it in the BS bag.
I believe that the hole exists. But
the hole exists.
It's just 100%. A hole, like I said, an opening to a cavern. That's probably what it is.
But nobody, look, did he really do all this? You're talking 15 miles of fishing line. Look.
Seems a little bit much, right?
If he would have just said, hey, look, I put 1,000 feet down in there and I hit no water, that would have been grand enough for me to be like, man, that's pretty interesting. 1,000 foot deep and there's no water, there's no nothing.
Yeah.
But when you start really making these outlandish claims of 15 miles, it's a little crazy. But so, folks, Thank you so much for all the emails, for all the stuff. I hope that whets your appetite. I hope maybe if nothing else, it kind of explained a few things. That's the stuff that I found. It was really interesting. I really loved it. I hope y'all enjoyed it. We had a great time covering it for y'all. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Cam, thank you for sharing that. That is an incredible story. Like I said, I think it's a large exaggeration of what probably really happened. But nonetheless, it's interesting to hear the stories. Like I say, don't ever let the truth stand in the way of a good story.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It's very entertaining to contemplate. Real quick before we wrap up today, I'd like to give a shout out to a blog you guys should check out. It's called Monsters and Magic, and it's cryptozoology and paranormal from a magical perspective. And you can go there. I'll put links to it in the show notes, or if you want to just go directly over, it's monstersandmagic.wordpress.com. Pretty interesting stuff over there. If you'd like to help out the show, Expanded Perspectives, please go to iTunes. You can rate and write us a review. That really helps out when other people are searching for new podcasts to listen to. When they come across our show, if they're not inspired by the artwork, they definitely can see from the reviews and stuff that it's a really good show. It leads to more people checking us out. Also, don't forget, if you are a big fan of Expanded Perspectives, we do an additional show.
That's right, we do. We'll drop a little clip of it right quick just to whet everybody's appetite. Let me read it for you. They call it the Hairy Man Beast of Darien, Panama, actually. Now, this comes from a fellow named Richard Marsh. He passed away in 1953. He was an engineer, actually, down in that area, doing some looking around and exploring and helping basically kind of go through part of the jungles and stuff. And there's a part down there they call the Panama's Darien Gap, which basically is about a 10,000-square-mile area of what they call impenetrable jungle in this area that it borders Central and South America. There's a lot of, you know, they say that's where a lot of the Colombian drug lords and stuff would hide stuff in this area, and like gorillas. And I don't mean like the hairy ones. We're talking about dudes with the guns. Mm-hmm. They're down in there, and men with machetes. I mean, you got to imagine all the stuff that's down in this little no man's land, basically, area. But this took place, and this is Marsh telling this story, and he calls it the Man Beast of Darien. It says, in 1920, while I was in Panama, an old and experienced American prospector, Shay by name, came to me with a strange story. He had just returned from a trip to southeastern Darien. With another American, he had ascended the Sambu River, which enters the sea on the southern shore of San Miguel Bay. The country here was, and still is, wholly unknown. Even the mountain range back from the coast did not appear on the maps. Shay and his companion worked their way with great difficulty to the headwaters of the Sambu, and there they became separated. The other American has not been heard from since. When Shay lost his companion, he lost his canoe and most of his equipment. So instead of attempting to return down the Sambu River, he decided to forge his way to the Pacific Ocean, across the Andean Range to the west. He reached the divide in a state of exhaustion, and by a stroke of luck, stumbled on an old Indian dugout abandoned on the bank of a small river running into Penas Bay. It was nearly dark, so he camped for the night at a considerable altitude not far from the divide. Now, all that night, he heard the footsteps of a large animal in the jungle above his camp. And when dawn came, he heard a curious chattering sound. He looked up and saw standing on top of the bank an animal that appeared to his unscientific mind to be crossed between a Negro and a gigantic ape. It was 6 feet tall, walked erect, weighed possibly 300 pounds, and was covered with long black hair. It was glaring down at him
and chattering its teeth in rage. Shea whipped at his revolver and shot it through the head. It tumbled down the bank and lay still beside his canoe. When Shea recovered from his fright, he measured the animal crudely. It was heavily built like a gorilla, but the big toes on the feet were parallel with the other toes, as in a human being, not opposed like thumbs, as in all other monkeys and great apes. Now, unfortunately, Shea was too exhausted to bring any part of the animal back to civilization. He barely managed to get down the Pinas Bay on the Pacific and attract the attention of a coaster, which took him to Panama more dead than alive. I saw him many times after that in the hospital, where he eventually died from chronic malaria. Almost his last words were a solemn oath that the story of the man-beast was true. Now, of course, my first reaction to this story was extreme skepticism. But I found to my surprise that many trustworthy men who had penetrated into the little-known parts of tropical America did not share my disbelief. The man-beast is reported to have been seen in many locations. A Spanish gold-hunting expedition in the 17th century reported that it had shot 14 of the man-beasts not far from the same bay. The Indians from Ecuador to Nicaragua assert that the creatures inhabit isolated jungle-covered mountains, as do the gorillas in Africa, and nothing will persuade an Indian to spend the night on such a peak. It says, when I returned to Washington and mentioned the matter to Dr. Huff of the Smithsonian, I did not get the pitying smile I was expecting. On the contrary, he said that he had been getting reports of this sort for 20 years and was inclined to believe there was something in them. Now, Dr. Anthony of the New York Museum of Natural History has a story to tell of encountering a large unknown animal near the summit of Mount Terracuna on the Colombian border, and a Frenchman claims to have shot one in Ecuador.
And there you go, folks. If you want to hear a little bit more of that stuff, go to the website. You'll see it in the top right corner there. It says subscribe to Expanded Perspectives Elite. You click on that. You follow the rules. Everything comes through there. It's $5 a month. You get an extra show every Thursday. Also, too, if you want to email us, if you want to call and leave some voicemails, we get great voicemails to the show. Call 1-817-945-3828. We check it all the time. We get all kinds of great stuff there. Yeah. Just get in contact with us, man. We have a great time doing all of this stuff.
Everybody have a good week. Be safe. Cam, what do you got planned for this week?
I'm going to try to stay dry. I got a lot of paperwork I got to do at work this week. It's going to be crazy. I got a little bit more reading we got to do. We got some more books in. I got to cover some more of that stuff and get shined back up for the Thursday show. And then that's about it. Back to the grind again, man.
Back to the grind. Well, everybody take care. I'm Kyle Filson.
I'm Cam Hale. Peace.
of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at kosai.org.